Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network in New Books in Sports. I am Dr. Jorge Red from Texas Tech University, and today I am visiting with Gabe Logan, and we're going to talk a little bit about his book, The Early Years of Chicago Soccer, 1887 to 1939, which was published in 2019 by Lexington Books. Gabe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jorge. I'm happy to join you today.
I really like this book because, again, it's not just about soccer. It's not just about sport, but it is about the ramifications of people, different types of people playing sport and what it means to them as members of an ethnic group, members of a union, citizens of the city of Chicago. Why don't you take a few moments and tell us a little bit about yourself, your degrees, where you work, and how you came to be interested in this topic?
Sure. I currently am employed at Northern Michigan University in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, so we're somewhat remote, snowy capital on Lake Superior. I'm a full professor at NMU, and I'm also the contract officer for the faculty union. So those are my official titles and professor of history. My academic background, I started with a Bachelor of Science of Education at Missouri Southern in Joplin, Missouri, and I did my master's and doctorate in history after 10 years of teaching in the public schools at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb outside of Chicago. And my professors there, my academic focus was on immigration history and labor history. And I played soccer fairly competitively for 40 years. And so I wanted to take that athletic experience into my academics. And those were the two other prisms that I used to look at the history of early Chicago soccer through the prisms of labor history and immigration history and sport history.
Okay. Now, obviously, anyone who knows a little bit about the history of soccer in the United States recognizes that Chicago, along with St. Louis, were two of the principal hotbeds of the sport early on in the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century. Tell me a little bit about how you came to find out about the topic of Chicago soccer and sort of the history of Chicago soccer, and how did you make the decision to begin work on this project?
Yeah, when I was working on my master's, I took a closer look at the history of soccer in St. Louis, and I was intrigued by that because St. Louis has a little bit of a unique soccer history in that it was a, for lack of a better word, native-born sport. That is, it was readily available to those people playing in St. Louis beyond the immigrant community. And in fact, about the time soccer really took hold in St. Louis in the early 1900s, immigration had slowed quite a bit to St. Louis. yet the game continued alongside of United States football and significantly baseball. And so this guy planted the seed, and I asked this question, why is it a native sport in St. Louis and perceived to be a foreign sport elsewhere? And by that time, I had moved to Chicago, and I began looking at the leagues, and I wanted to see if that story played out in Chicago. And I found slight similarities in that it was embraced by the native-born community, but Chicago continued to have these immigration waves who also augmented the native community with new tactics. And so where the East Coast, where it was the professional leagues were primarily immigration leagues and immigrants brought over to play professional soccer, the Midwest seems to have been a little different in that it was native-born mostly in St. Louis and a mixture in Chicago.
Okay. Well, and we'll flesh out a lot more of these ideas as we begin going through the book. So let's just start off with really some of the basic points here. How does the game begin in Chicago? Who are the main participants? What did they hope to get out of the sport? And how does soccer interact with the traditional American sports like baseball and football that you mentioned? How does soccer interact with those other sports in the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century?
Right. British immigrants brought soccer to Chicago, primarily from Scotland, as they did in much of the world. That was the favored kicking code in Great Britain, England, Scotland, and Wales, and Northern Ireland. And when these immigrants arrived in Chicago, they wanted to recreate these sporting and recreation institutions. And they often developed in the Caledonian clubs for the Scottish and the cricket clubs for the English. And they were used to assert British identity and to kind of recreate pastimes that were popular in Great Britain. But they were also used to bring these immigrants together. So holidays such as the Queen's Birthday would be set aside, and soccer matches would be played along with other ways of asserting their ethnic identity. I found that one sport history often looks at the cricket clubs in the United States. They eventually drew middle-class Americans into them and changed into baseball clubs. But for those cricket clubs, certainly in Chicago, that remained cricket, this also became a place that soccer prospered. And that's often been overlooked by sport historians, that in these cricket clubs, while they made the transition from cricket to baseball, they were able to retain soccer. And that's what allowed it to develop in Chicago. In the late 1800s, soccer was one of the better non-baseball drawing games. Naturally, in Chicago, baseball was king. But crowds in the low thousands often turned out for these early soccer matches. This was especially the case at Pullman in South Chicago in the Pullman community, where soccer was probably the largest drawing game in the community. Other large fan support sporting events were the high school games for American football and, of course, Stagg at University of Chicago. And surprisingly, Chicago had a quite active Gaelic football that was taken up by the firstborn Irish community. And they also sponsored soccer alongside Gaelic football.
Okay. Now, one of the things that I found particularly interesting, and now we're moving, I guess, into chapter two of your book, is that ultimately there's such a level of support for soccer in Chicago that ultimately people like Charles Kaminsky and Ben Johnson baseball entrepreneurs become involved in the sport. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how that connection takes place?
Sure. That's a fascinating part of the story as well. Comiskey had longstanding roots to South Chicago, and that's where the game was initially played on an organized level. And one of the foremost teams, in addition to the Pullman Palace Car Company, was a cricket club known as the Wanderers Cricket Club. And it was their grounds that Comiskey purchased and erected Comiskey Park. So the White Sox were playing on an old cricket ground slash soccer field that had been going on for 20 years. So being the sport entrepreneur that he was, I'm sure he was aware of these large crowds that were turning out to see soccer and alongside cricket and alongside baseball. While this was taking on in the late 1800s, on the East Coast, there were six baseball franchises, I believe it was six, maybe eight, that were looking to fill their baseball stadiums in the fall. And so they tried to create a professional soccer league to play in the fall, and it lasted for 8 weeks. And several of the ball club owners in Chicago, including Comiskey, and in St. Louis and Detroit, Cleveland, they looked at that idea as well and said, let's try that in Chicago and in the Midwest. And in 1901, these four clubs put together a professional soccer league, and I think one of the goals was to fill the stadiums in the fall, but it didn't work out too well. The train fares wouldn't give them a break to haul the athletes from city to city. Detroit immediately dropped out. Milwaukee jumped in, and so there was this inner city league between Cleveland, St. Louis, Chicago, and Milwaukee. And then Cleveland went away, so it was just the three remaining teams, and it lasted for a home and away series each, and then the plug was pulled on that.
Now, let me ask you this then. Why was there, do you think, a certain amount of resistance to soccer? Was that part of the issue as well, you know, besides the economic, the cost of moving the players from one to another? Was soccer, even at this point, was soccer considered, quote, a foreign sport?
Certainly not in St. Louis.
Okay.
And the Chicago professional team, it was mostly British, but they had a number of Illinois-born players on there as well. I don't think there was any resistance to it. The initial game, it was a downpour in St. Louis, and people didn't show up. It was a paltry crowd, and the St. Louis team wouldn't split the gate with Chicago, and money started coming out of the players' pocket and Comiskey pocket, and he said, "Well, you know, I'm not doing that."
Yeah.
However, Comiskey remained a strong supporter of Chicago soccer all the way up to the 1940s, and often large games were played in his stadium, and he was on several committees that sponsored the game, both semi-professionally and professionally in the city.
Okay. Now, another part of chapter two that you discuss is, how does immigration and emphasis on recreation during the Progressive Era, now we're moving into the very early part of the 20th century, how does this emphasis on recreation, the issue of continued immigration in Chicago, and the growing influence of labor, how do all three of those areas sort of influence the game of soccer in Chicago?
Yeah. The Progressive period, for sport historians, one of the hallmarks was the playground movement. Mm-hmm. And this coincided, you know, again, Chicago had the Hull House and was quite concerned with how to take care of immigrants, how to Americanize immigrants. And they had this park director by the name of Edward DeGroot, who was quite the enthusiastic soccer supporter. and around Pullman in the South Park City, it was South Parks around Pullman and South Chicago, as these playgrounds began to develop, he insisted that soccer be a part of it. And he created a significant soccer program in the South Parks, beginning with the midget leagues or juniors, all the way up to adults. And Jerry Jims has done a lot of work on this, and Stephen Reese, where these athletic fields in the parks became contested between the various groups for baseball and football. In soccer, that wasn't the case. The fields weren't contested. They were used to play soccer, and it became this youth inter-ethnic, for lack of a better word, melting pot of bringing all these different immigrant group children together to play in the city. So the South Parks and DeGroote, his efforts really incubated these firstborn and native-born players that would continue to play the game during the Progressive era and into the 1920s.
Okay. Well, and actually, that answer is a very nice transition to Chapter 3, which is in which you discuss the rise of native-born soccer players. So how did this change the setting or the reality of soccer in Chicago during the latter part of the Progressive era?
Yeah. After World War I, the nativist movements in the United States and 1924 brought the century of immigration to a close with the quota system, as we all, as historians know. So this cut off the pipeline of these immigrants that were coming unfettered into the United States and Chicago. They were often young males, and they were bringing their sporting and soccer traditions with them to Chicago. So that pipeline was shut off. And in its place, there was all these players that had played in the high schools and had played in the park districts that were now reaching the age to play for the clubs in Chicago as adults. And so it took on a much more significant native flavor. And I think what exemplifies this the most, in 1920, St. Louis entered the United States Open Cup for the first time, and that's the top soccer trophy in the United States. And fittingly, St. Louis had an all-native-born St. Louis team, and they played an all-English-born Fall River, Massachusetts, Four River, Massachusetts team, and St. Louis won. And it's seen as in soccer history terms, this big movement of the first time St. Louis enters, they bring a native-born team in, and they win the championship. Mm-hmm. On their way to winning that game, they had to go through Chicago, and it was a heck of a game. They ended up playing Olympia, and that was a team out of Chicago's Czech community, but everyone on that team was also all Chicago-born. And so I think that quarterfinal game gives a much more flavor of what was happening in the Midwest and the level of talent as compared to the East Coast.
Okay. And again, you've touched upon some of the an aspect of the question that you develop in Chapter 4, which is, you know, given your background in education, I think that would have been particularly of interest to you. But tell us a little bit about how high school soccer develops in Chicago. What are some of the key teams? Who are some of the key individuals involved?
Uh-huh. The game started in 1904, I believe, in Lane Tech and Englewood High School in the city. And a gentleman by the name of Archibald Bryce was an early soccerite in Chicago. He had played in England, and he was also also in the school districts. And so he wanted soccer to be there alongside football and baseball and the other sports that were being played. And mm-hmm. So he introduced the game in 1904, and it was well received. Then I think that same year, possibly 1906, Oak Park, which is a suburb of Chicago, the first suburb outside Chicago, also adopted soccer. And along with another suburban high school, Morton. And so there was this initial four-team circuit that played for a city championship and played for a suburban championship, and then those two teams came together. And within a fairly short amount of time, by the 1920s, there was about 15, 20 schools that were featuring varsity soccer. And so it was another one of these incubation centers. And a lot of these kids, as they graduated from high school, realized they still like playing the game and continued into the adult leagues.
Okay. Another aspect of Chapter 4 is the development of some of these players into professionals. Tell us a little bit about that.
The best example for that would be Morton High School, and this was the high school of the Czech community. And the Czechs entered Chicago soccer quite aggressively to challenge the native-born teams and the English and Scottish teams with their own brand of soccer and the large Czech community in the city. And so they had these juvenile teams. But they looked around, also saw the possibility of the high school team. Mm-hmm. And so they aligned their professional team, Sparta Soccer Club, and they supplied coaches and facilities and sometimes uniforms to Morton High School. And a lot of these players ended up playing both on the juvenile team and in the high school team, and then just graduating right up into the adult leagues. In fact, when Sparta finally brought the Open Cup to Chicago for the first time, a quarter of that team had roots from that high school, from their high school experience.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about, now we're moving out beyond the progressive era, and now we're getting closer to the coming of the Great Depression. How does the Great Depression impact the game?
Yeah, well, obviously the economic engine of the United States shuts down, and some of the stronger professional teams that were sponsored by industry, such as the Pullman Car Builders, Joliet Steel, the Bricklayers Union, the Carpenters Union, these were powerful professional teams that were bringing players in to play, and that was their job. And it was good for the, in the case of the Bricklayers, it was a union sporting voice to play against company teams like Pullman or like Joliet Steel. When the Great Depression came along, of course, this financial backing collapsed, and the professional teams that were quite vibrant in the city fell apart, and they had to turn to the ethnic clubs for support that were still able to pay these players. And so this is Sparta really takes off in the Czech community, Kuppenheimer in the Jewish community, the clothing store. So the Great Depression causes the old industrial teams to kind of go by the wayside, and mm-hmm. the ethnic clubs come into prominence.
Okay.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Tell me a little bit more about the various ethnics. You've mentioned Sparta, you've mentioned a couple others. Are there any other ethnic clubs that you found particularly interesting as you were doing your research?
Yeah, by the late 1920s, almost every ethnic community in Chicago seemed to have fielded a team. The Germans had their own league, and they would put together a championship German team that would play the other ethnic teams. The Italians had several teams. The Danes, the Scandinavians, all the Scandinavian countries, Danes, Norwegians, Swedes, they all had clubs and teams that competed. The Polish communities, kind of a surprise given Chicago's long history, it took them till 1929 to bring a team into the league. And when they did, they never looked back. And then per your own research, the Latino communities in Chicago, it would be in the late 20s, but mostly during the Great Depression, where they too would enter teams. And the first Mexican team in Chicago took its name from Necaxa in Mexico, and the Electricians. And they were part of the old Chicago Communist League, where they found a home. And humble beginnings, and they're still alive and well.
Really? Now that I didn't know, tell me a little bit about, you know, Necaxa, this Mexican team that has had, you know, obviously a very long run in the history of Chicago. What can you tell us about that?
I think the records are scarce with the origins of this team. Mm-hmm. The community members seem to have come from the part of Mexico that was also where Necaxa's soccer team is, and use that name in honor of where they came from. League fees were expensive, but 14 teams got together under the auspice of the Communist Party in Chicago, and the games were cheaper. They played in the parks. They fielded their own referees, very low cost. And so they began playing in the Labor Sport Union into the Communist League. And then as the Great Depression finally lifted after World War II, their clubhouse that they purchased was the old socialist, was one of the old German Turnerbund Socialist Hall. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another connection of this playing for the people movement. Of course, now the Latino and Latinx communities in Chicago, you know, it's one of the main engines of the soccer in Chicago today. Okay. And it started back then.
Okay. Now, and again, you've touched a bit on this, and this is actually taking us into chapter five. How does the game change during the years of the Great Depression, and what role does this growing diversity among Chicago's immigrant, how does it impact the sport at this time? You know, you're making it sound as if these different ethnic teams had, you know, good competition, and you didn't have any issues as far as, a very bitter rivalry. Was that the case, or did you have situations where maybe things got a little out of hand between particular clubs?
The ethnic communities by the Great Depression became sponsors of the team, and they were always happy to have the sons of the first immigrants, and sometimes the daughters. Every now and then they would have a female team in the ethnic clubs. Mm-hmm. But so But they were also looking to win. And with the immigration pipeline cut off, these teams, such as Sparta, they began to look for the best players. And the German clubs did this as well. So these old industrial teams that went under, now these players were, they would play for the team that would pay them as much as anybody could. Yeah. And so it became an ethnic club, but the players tended to play for that club. They weren't necessarily of that ethnic community, although many were. That was the big change. And then the second, I had to look at, okay, what businesses were able to continue during the Great Depression? Mm-hmm. And ethnic department stores, such as Webolts, such as Leaders in Chicago, these people, milk and dairy companies as well, Ogden, they began to pick up the bill to sponsor soccer teams. So it moved from these industrial backings to these smaller community enterprises that began backing them in conjunction with the ethnic club.
Okay.
And then another big one was the repeal of Prohibition.
Right.
And the beer industry began to sponsor teams as well.
Well, and you know what, as you were mentioning that I actually was just jotting that down. Tell us a little bit about the beer clubs and how significant those organizations were.
This is one of my favorite stories I stumbled across in the book.
I figured as much.
In Milwaukee, Schlitz put together a big team. Schlitz put together the best players in Milwaukee and were drawing that. St. Louis, of course, with Anheuser-Busch, their big team was the Central Brewing Company. And a lot of these East Coast players that no longer had a team to play for found their way to the Midwest to play for the breweries. One of Chicago's breweries at the time was the Manhattan Brewing Company. And in 1938, they said, we're going to put together a team. And it went from not having a team to collecting some of the best soccer stars in Chicago and the United States. And in one season, Manhattan Brewers went from not having a team to runner-up in the National Cup to folding. And it was a meteoric rise and just a sudden crashing ending for it. Manhattan Brewery, of course, is quite the controversial brewery because it was mafia money.
Really?
And, Johnny Torino had that brewery. And then when he gave up the mob and went back to Italy, Al Capone took it over. And it was one of the producers of near beer and beer in Chicago. And then in the 1930s, when Prohibition went away, the mafia took over the bartenders union in Chicago and said, you're going to sell Manhattan. And there's in the book, I've traced that record of how they threatened the union bosses and the bartenders union with death threats and so forth. But it worked. And Manhattan became the leading selling beer in Chicago. And part of those profits went to field this phenomenal soccer team.
Then it seems like they had a pretty good, pardon me for saying it this way, racket going on here. Why does the team fold then so quickly after a championship season?
I think Manhattan became soured on the prospect after that one season and one loss. They'd put in all this money. They had hired the former runner-up of the mayor, a guy by the name of Luden, who was also the postmaster. He was the Republican candidate for the mayor. He became president of the company. And they'd put a significant amount of money into this team, and they had purchased uniforms. They'd purchased these players' contracts. They had bought the rights to a soccer facility, and it wasn't and radio announcement, and it wasn't paying off. I guess it was all or nothing. They won the championship, or they're pulling the plug, and so it only lasted this one season.
Okay. Now, let me just backtrack just for a second, because you also did mention in passing that there were some female clubs. What can you tell us about their experiences. What did the game mean to these women? How long did the game, did these teams last, and what was significant about them?
This was a very challenging part of the book to research. And it mostly lent itself to a couple of passing references in the newspapers and three photographs. But this was also part of the Park District, and the Park District offered soccer for the female gymnasiums. And two businesses, the Trans Workers, which was a transportation outfit, put together a females recreation team, and the players for that seem to have come from the Park District, the graduates from the Park District. The other was, again, Sparta, who put together a women's team, a late teenager, early adult women's team. All I have of that is an image, but it seems like it had a connection to Western Electric, which hired a lot of Czechoslovakian American women to work in their factories. And the other was Pullman, and Pullman Technical School put together a soccer team, a female soccer team. And these three teams played each other in a home and away series for a round robin from about 1922 through, I think, 1925.
Okay. You know what? Let me just ask you one other point from this particular chapter, chapter five. You've touched on it, but I want you to maybe spend a couple minutes on this. How does soccer give back to the community during the era of the Great Depression? What are these soccer teams doing now? You kind of have touched upon this, especially with the discussion of some of the beer teams and sort of the impact that they have. But how does soccer give back to the community during these difficult economic times of the Great Depression?
There were a couple of matches that were where the gate went to the unemployed community. And so the ethnic communities would have these all-star games or these championship matches, and the players were donating their time, and that the profit from those would go back to the various clubs' membership who were struggling to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. So that would be one way. It also served as a point of ethnic pride. The soccer teams were saying, well, we're still here, we're still playing, we're still surviving. And the people could point to that, go to the games for relatively, it wasn't anything like in the 20s, but tickets were still modestly priced to where people could go. And looking at some of the images from those times, this was a place to be dressed up for. It was a significant social outing. Mm-hmm. And so I think it became a point of civic pride to still have these teams. There were charity matches that gave back to the community. Those were the two big points during the Great Depression.
Okay. Was there any connection between some of these clubs and, say, religious organizations? And did that impact the sport in any way?
Not that I found. Okay. That changes from St. Louis. In St. Louis, the Catholic Solidarities were sponsoring the clubs. That wasn't necessarily the case in Chicago.
Okay. One last question as far as the timeline that you present in the manuscript. You finish off in 1939. How does the sport of soccer change in Chicago after that moment in time? Why do you end the book in 1939, and how do things change after the start of World War II?
In 1938, 1939, and 1940, Chicago sent a team to the championship match of the Open Cup and won two of them. And that's the first time the trophy ever came to Chicago. And mm-hmm. those three seasons tend to mark the pinnacle of Chicago reaching the top of the game in the United States. And so that's why I ended the work there. When World War II came around, as much like World War I, the league lost a significant amount of its members who went to fight in the war. And when they came back, once again, the immigration pipelines opened up again, and these ethnic communities saw a degree of a renaissance in terms of players that came to Chicago and rejuvenated the game. I think it seems to have not been the same way it was in World War I, where there were all these native-born players that they had to compete with. Now, after World War II, the game seemed to move more into a European or South American or Central American understanding of the game, migrating into the ethnic clubs.
Okay. Now, you don't live in the Chicago area anymore, but and you've touched upon it when we were discussing Necaxa. How does the game? What role does the game play in the city of Chicago at the present time? From what you've seen,
it's a mixed bag. It's wonderfully popular in terms of players, and almost any given day there will be 100 games being played, both indoor and outdoor. But the pro league and the pro team, when it initially came out, it was pretty well attended, and they just haven't been able that the Chicago Fire haven't been able to match what they did when they first started. And so the fan base has turned away. Now there's new owners and they're moving it back into Soldier Field, which that's going to be interesting since the Chicago Fire had trouble filling 20,000 soccer specific stadium fans in it, what it's going to look like in the 68,000 Soldier Field. But we'll see.
Okay. Are you working on a follow-up to this? Is this something that you're going to maybe continue to research?
Two papers I'm currently working on. One of them has to do with Detroit soccer. The Holly Carburetor Company put together quite a unique team as well that was also a powerhouse in the Midwest, and I'm looking at them. And the research that I stumbled on with Chicago soccer was this Communist League and their whole athletic body, the Labor Sport Union. I've put together two papers out of that, and I'm looking to maybe turn that into a modest monograph.
Okay, great. Well, is there any point or any issue in the book that we haven't discussed that you feel is you want to provide that information to our listeners?
I do. Another intriguing story had to do with Anton Cermak, the mayor of Chicago, who was assassinated when he was with FDR in Florida. And Cermak was born in Czechoslovakia, but he grew up in Braidwood, Illinois, and Chicago, Illinois. And it's the political history behind him has been that one of the ways he was able to take over the mayorship was his use of the prohibition issue. He wanted Chicago to stay wet. What this book uncovered was his deep roots and involvement with soccer, and he used it as a way to reach the various immigrant communities that hasn't been recognized until this work. And I found that quite intriguing.
Okay. So in other words, soccer or sport in general was an effective mechanism for a particular politician or a particular political party to be able to gain entry and to gain a certain amount of favor with individual ethnic groups.
Yes, Agreed. And the constituents, he understood who was coming to the game, and he understood that it was a way to get its vote, to get a vote. And the Mayor Cup in Chicago started with as the Cermak Cup back in the 1920s, and it still continues today.
Okay. Who are the dominant teams at the present time for that cup?
Ooh, usually out of the German clubs, Schwaben and the Vikings, those tend to be the strongest teams. There's the Metro League in Chicago tends to be the strongest league in Chicago today, and those are teams from that league are generally the contenders.
Okay. Well, Gabe, we're at about 43 minutes into our discussion, and I appreciate you taking the time to visit with me today, especially at this moment in time as you're grading papers to finish out your semester. Thank you so much for visiting with me. This is a wonderful project. I strongly encourage people to pick up a copy of the book. I want to thank you for being on the show with me today, and I really enjoyed it. I hope you had a good time.
I certainly did, and I thank you for taking the time to bring it out to people's attention. It's been a labor of love.
Thank you very much.